The following teaching is part one in a 20-part series by Dr. Ken Boa titled, Answering the Tough Questions About Life and God.
We are looking at the issue of the tough questions that people raise. And if you've got one of these flyers, you'll see that there's a sequence of 12 of these questions that are actually based upon the chapters found in a book I wrote with Larry Moody called I'm Glad You Asked. The problem with that book is when people say, what's the name of your book? And I say, I'm glad you asked. Then they say, yes, but what's the name of your book? What we're going to do tonight is preliminary to these questions in this book. Up until the last couple of decades, when the issue of ultimate reality, the issue of what do you really believe in, what's your worldview, when those things would come up, these kinds of objections would often surface, and they'd have a common discourse. They'd have at least the idea that there are some things that are true and some things are not true and so forth. But these days, there's been quite a bit of a change because we've moved into what's often been called a postmodern world. And in a postmodern world, as we're going to see in just a minute, a lot of people struggle with the question of whether anything can be true. And so we have to really deal with that issue before you can start looking at these kinds of questions. How can you know that anything is true, is what we've moved into, and I'll explain why that's happened. After doing that, and we're going to be looking at that issue of truth and the issue of authority and why we believe, why a person would believe what a person believes, what are their options, what are the basic worldviews that are available to us. All I'm going to be suggesting here tonight is it's not my job here, wherever you are in your spiritual journey, to convert you or to persuade you, but only to expose things to you rather than impose. All I'm trying to do is help you think through some issues, and this is a safe place. I'm not going to say we have special cards here for those who are new members or new visitors. That's a special packet. I'm not going to introduce you. I'm not going to ask who's new. None of that. So this is a safe place. All we're going to do is think some issues through together. At the same time, I also need to tell you that this is a series that could take us several years to go through if you wanted to do it with some measure of completeness. On any of these questions, you could go into as much depth as you would like. That's not going to be my intention, because if I did that and spent 3 years going through these questions, maybe a dozen sessions on each one, I'd probably have two of you left at the end of that session. I'd drive you all out of here. So instead of doing that, all I plan to do is to give you the overview. What are the key issues in each of these questions? That's all I'm going to try to do. Kind of sketch and suggest that there are great resources out there where one can go to getting more detailed answers. So that's just all I'm going to try to do. And what I plan to do as well in the weeks ahead is to provide for you a one or two page summary of each of these questions as a handout. And that way you can follow through with me and we can just think through the basic issues that are involved in every one of these questions. There's a certain way of approaching this. You need to understand, it's not like these questions haven't been answered before and asked before. You need to understand that really all the objections that I've just outlined and all the other kinds of objections you might think of are basic variations of things that have been raised 2,000 years ago. Understand that Christianity was birthed in a very pluralistic environment. Understand that in the Roman world, there wasn't one religion. There were a multiplicity of gods, multiplicity of mystery religions, multiplicity of philosophies. It was a very, very energetic culture in which there were areas where ideas were batted around. For example, in the Stoa, the Agora, the marketplaces. There in Athens, for example, where philosophers, the Epicureans, the Stoics would meet and they would discuss issues and so forth. It's not as though people were stupid in that days or provincial, not in the Roman Empire. These were people who were sophisticated thinkers. And frankly, when you read the works of the Greeks and the Romans from that period, we're not dealing with a bunch of yokels. We're dealing with folks whose philosophical skills outstrip most of the modern philosophers. I submit to you a reading of Plato, going back to some of those in Aristotle. We haven't had much of that since, to be perfectly frank. There are some wonderful lights and great moments here along the way, but I'm suggesting it's not as though people have gotten brighter in these areas. People have always wrestled with these issues, and we wrestle with them today. We have some new twists on some old ideas. And that's what we'll be talking about when we talk about this idea that I just mentioned, postmodernism. I'll try to allow a little time as well for questions and answers, or what I might do is every so often, every few times we meet, break for a Q&A session. So your job is to write down any questions that surface in your mind along the way. Don't forget to write them down. You'll forget them otherwise. And that way we can have a one-hour session from time to time to deal with those very kinds of questions, because obviously I couldn't attempt to answer all those things up front. I'm just giving you, again, a sketch of these issues. And all I want to do is for us to think together. The heart cannot rejoice in what the mind rejects. It's needful for us to have a clear way of thinking. And in my view, we're holistic beings. And by that I mean that we have intellects, we have emotions, we have wills. We have many facets to our being, and they ought to intersect and affect one another in realistic and coherent ways. So that if a person is committing mental suicide, intellectual suicide, as so often people have the stereotype of the person who goes into church and checks his brain at the door, you know, and then picks it up as he leaves. Sadly, sometimes that can be the case. The problem with some of these objections is there's sometimes, for example, the hypocrisy thing, a good deal of truth to it. And so we need to understand that and surface and be very open and honest about that. So let's take a look then at this issue of truth and the implications that it has, and what are the options available to us? Let's kind of back off and see what really, when we look at this cafeteria of choices out there for us, what are the really real variations of the worldviews that we could consider? Obi-Wan Kenobi speaking to in The Return of the Jedi, speaking to Luke Skywalker, made this very important set of observations. He says, what I told you was true from a certain point of view. Phrase, certain point of view. Luke, you're going to find out that many of the truths we cling to depend greatly on our point of view. Now that is a communication of a somewhat relativistic philosophy. It makes a good deal of sense that he'd say that, though, because if you checked it out, you recall at the beginning of the trilogy that Luke Skywalker was exhorted not to think, but to feel, to trust himself and not to worry about thinking it through, but to trust to his feelings and entrust himself to the Force. Remember that, all the exercises he'd be learning to be a Jedi Knight and so forth? So he was told basically to trust himself in all his being to this thing called the Force, only later to discover that it's the dark side of the Force that seduced his father, Darth Vader. So wait a minute now. What if you trust yourself to the Force? Now you find out there's a dark side that could seduce you. How do you know which part you're going to be entrusting yourself to? So it all depends, you see, on what point of view you're coming up with, and that you need to realize that all these things don't fit very well together sometimes. Now, what I'm suggesting here is that that's a fairly postmodern sort of concept. Up until the Enlightenment, with the Renaissance and so forth, there was a return to a sort of a Greek mindset. And what you had there was the concept of a system that we could look at like this. I'm going to summarize this in a very simple way, and it's somewhat simplistic, but it'll capture what I'm looking for. If you look at the worldview of Greece and Rome, essentially, you had basically a logical and also an open system. The system was based upon logic, reasoning, and thinking things through, and it was open to some measure of the transcendent, some other reality. Does that make sense to you, the philosophies? And certainly Christianity fit well with that, and it really embraced that idea that it was not irrational. In fact, it was a faith that claimed to be founded on facts. Jesus says, if you don't believe on account of the things that I tell you, believe on the basis of what you have seen with your eyes and the miracles themselves that these bear witness of me, that I have come forth from God and so forth. Essentially, Christianity claimed to be a faith founded on fact, and that reason and revelation, reason and faith did not have to be at loggerheads one with the other. But what happened after a period of time, especially during the Byzantine and medieval period, and this wasn't true for all, but for many people, what took place is it became more mystical and open. In other words, it was based upon the idea not so much of reason in many schools. Now, surely that was not true of the scholastics, but there was a growing movement toward that kind of the idea of openness here to mystical experience that God was so distant he could not be known, particularly in the Eastern Church. It was called apophatic theology, which meant that God was hidden. You couldn't know him. It was a mystical understanding. Then with the Enlightenment, what took place? You can kind of guess what took place here. You went back to logical, did you not? The whole idea is, let's go back to reason here. So we went back to a logical system, did we not? But what happened was with respect to the transcendent order? Pretty much the door was shut, and so it was a closed system. Essentially, you don't need that hypothesis, as was put. You simply can come up with a credible understanding of life without the need of any supernatural aid or revelation. You could pretty well sort that out through the application of reason. But now we move into a more modern period, and particularly a postmodern period as we move from there, and I'll define just a little bit more what I mean by that. Where do you suppose we are now? My suggestion is, for many people, we've gone back to a mystical. By the way, the reason for it is because when you go too far and have a closed system and pure logic, nobody's home in the universe, and it gets mighty lonely, especially when people are still looking for some kind of meaning, significance, and purpose in life. And if it's not embedded in any personal relationship, if there's no transcendent order, what happens is, as I've often put it, the system becomes corroded in the acids of its own assumptions. It's hard to live with. It's hard to live with the idea of a total cynicism. Suppose you, for example, say that we can't know anything at all, yet you don't live that way. Because if you live that way, and there's no real ultimate meaning in life, you probably wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. The real question for Sartre and Camus was, why not commit suicide? At least they were being consistent with the logical implications, or more consistent, but in their own lives they belied that because they became passionate about various political causes. For example, the Spanish Civil War. And the question, why would you get involved with that if life is ultimately absurd? What I'm saying is people can't live as if there are no windows, as if life is just in this closed materialistic construct of a universe, but rather there's got to be more. We have aspirations and longings for something more. The question is there anyone home? And if we have a mystical closed system, as I'm suggesting we are moving toward, it seems to be that there is the illusion of a transcendent order, but without the reality. Ultimately, you don't have any real personal being at the end of the day, but you still have some kind of a mystical feeling about that. The kind of thing that you might describe was the feeling that you might have had when you saw certain movies. For example, E.T. What was evocative in the movie E.T.? Do you recall the feelings that it produced, or Close Encounters of the Third Kind? Do you remember those two movies? They're good examples of what I have in mind. What's the ultimate reality there? If you really analyzed it, if you really looked at the philosophy, it was pretty much probably a materialistic worldview. In other words, ultimate reality is still not a spiritual or personal, but you had these other agents, other beings outside that had magical kinds of abilities. They were more evolved, they were further down the road, and so it had an evocation of the transcendent, some sense of magic, some sense of wonder, and people resonated that with that concept. There seemed to be something that, if there's someone out there, maybe my life is more significant. If you press hard enough, it's not entirely clear why that would be true. You see where I'm going with that? I'm just suggesting that if you press the issues of the philosophies, though, you find out that upon analysis, though, they're really not open to some transcendent order. Here's what happened in our time. After the Enlightenment Project, As you move from the 18th century into the 19th century and the technical revolution and so forth, the industrial revolution, and then into the 20th century with the information revolution, what's taking place here is the tremendous exponential growth in our technique, our science, our ability to control and manipulate reality. A powerful concept, a powerful ability for us to do so. At the same time, what's been happening, though, at the very point where we are gaining greater facility and ability to so-called master nature, at the same time, we have become suddenly very, very skeptical, particularly in the last few decades, about the meaning of nature itself, the meaning of truth, whether there's something out there that we can all correspond to. Here's what happened. With the Enlightenment, prior to the Enlightenment and during the Enlightenment, a little bit after, there were two basic ways of trying to arrive at answers about life. And by the way, Francis Schaeffer put it well when he drew what he called the line of despair. Watch this, and you'll see what I mean. Schaeffer, I think, was right in a general sense when he said that it was philosophy that first got on to a new concept, a new revolution, but the philosophers didn't really touch the average person. That trickled down. After the first people to pick it up after the philosophers would be the artists. They had an instinctual understanding, not that they could say this was why, but they picked up the kind of the wind of the philosophical movement, and musicians soon followed. And then, and so that if you look, for example, at Impressionism, there was a certain philosophy that actually embraced, and also was expressed in Impressionism in music. For example, when you think of Debussy and Ravel, or when you think of Erik Satie, there is definitely underlying that a certain point of view that's being expressed through the medium of music. When you move from music, then it would move, he would say, and I think rightly so, into general culture. Today, that might mean literature. It would mean drama, plays, and so forth. It would also mean film. And so it moved into film. And by the way, these days, that's become the most powerful medium as a general medium that influences our thinking. It's an awesome, powerful medium that moves you into a total environment where nothing you hear, see, is outside that realm. You're in a closed environment. Everything you hear and see is being kind of ordered for you. So you're there for a pretty big chunk of time. Some of these movies are going now 3 hours and longer, as you know. So, and then the last folks who seem to pick it up are the theologians. They're always kind of the last on the rung there. They're the last ones to catch on. They think they're being very profound. So they come up with stuff that the philosophers were talking about 50 years before. Kind of intriguing. What are they teaching in seminaries? Well, up until very recently, it was process theology. The interesting thing about that is about 50 years behind Wittgenstein and others. And the fascinating thing is by the time the process theology came along, that was already now out of date in philosophical circles. But that's okay. They're thinking on their own cutting edge. So they're telling these seminaries, we got it down now. The Bible's totally irrelevant. This is where it's at. So the interesting irony here is that desperately trying to be current, relevant, and up to date and with it, they are basically kind of a bubble in the back of culture. By the time they catch on, culture had already moved down here. So the interesting development then is that there are ideas that get in the wind and begin to influence people in powerful ways. And people today don't know why they're believing what they do, but they do. You're being shaped by the media, which in turn is being shaped by philosophies behind that. That the media shapes the culture, but the culture also shapes the media, and there's a kind of a mutual reinforcement. What I'm suggesting, especially in our time, is that we've moved more and more from what was originally an oral culture to a literary or written culture, and now we're moving into a visual culture. If you go back to this idea, have any of you read the book "Amusing Ourselves to Death" by Neil Postman? Just out of curiosity, it's a great cover where you see these four, a family looking at TV. Only none of them, you look closely, none of them have any heads. So it's kind of like this idea that they're just passively looking at this box here, amusing themselves to death, and not thinking a bit, nor are they relating one to another. That's what the interesting thing is, when they're watching sitcoms, they're looking at least at families who don't watch TV. Now, you ever think about that? When you're, I mean, imagine a comedy or a movie or a TV show about people who are watching TV. That'd be pretty boring, wouldn't it? I don't believe it would last very long. And you see, the point is that people are now not thinking, they're reacting. In fact, they don't have any problem with the plot line suddenly being interrupted by a Rolaid band commercial or by something that'll deal with any product that they want to tell you and then get back into this thing. Imagine you're reading a novel and suddenly it has a commercial in the next paragraph and then, now back to our story. Wouldn't that be offensive? You see the idea here? But we accept that as being quite normal. Stop a play right in the middle. Oh, and now a word from our sponsor. This seems something wrong here, you see? But we accept that. And what's happened is people aren't thinking very well anymore. In fact, they can't think for a long time. Short attention span theater is a good name, because people's attention spans have become very reduced. They can't think discursively and clearly and logically anymore. And all I'm suggesting is that we back off and realize that we are vulnerable as a result, ironically, to the all kinds of winds of teaching and thought, unless we start thinking and asking ourselves some tough questions. Who am I? Where did I come from? Why am I here? And where am I going? And why do I believe what I believe? What's my source of authority? If you don't ask these questions, you will react, not think. You will not be proactive, you'll be reactive. And your life will be determined by others' agenda. The agenda of the ambient culture will pretty well define for you by default what you believe and what's valuable and what to go for. And frankly, everyone's getting more and more homogenized. They're not thinking anymore. They're becoming homogeneous in their thought life. It's fascinating how that's working. Now, what happened was this. Let's go back a little bit, because I've got many more things that we want to look at here as we back out. There were two basic ways of arriving at truth. There were rationalists, and the rationalists thought that you could basically arrive at truth, but without needing our sensory apparatus, your mind itself. You could sort out things by using your mental reasoning facility. The empiricists, and they were writing at the same time, by contrast, went the opposite extreme, and they said, the only thing you know is what your senses tell you. You see, it's just a question of sensory input and determining things on the basis of that. You're merely a tabula rasa, and that things are now have to be learned through our senses, and that's how that works. The problem with the rationalists, of course, is that pure reason has nothing to know. Because without sensations, without experience, you just wouldn't know anything in the outside world. The problem here, though, is sensations by themselves can't be known unless you have some kind of interpretive device to analyze it. You see the problem here? Both of them turned out to have big, big problems, rationalism and empiricism. Rationalists said that you'd come by using your mind, your reason. But at the same time, the empiricists, who said it's actually your senses, both were right and both were wrong, Kant said. So the great philosopher Immanuel Kant said essentially in his critique of pure reason that actually pure reason by itself isn't enough. You got to have some categories that are built in, that are there so you can impose that upon the structure of reality. You didn't think I was going to tell you about philosophy tonight, did you here? Categories such as space, categories such as causality and time and so forth. And that you impose those categories on sensory experience so that as a result there'd be a melding of your mind and your experience. The problem, Kant said, though, is this. Here's the rub. You can't really know reality as such. You can only know the phenomena, but you can't know what's behind it, what he called the noumenos. And therefore, you're limited just to what appears to be real, but you have no clue as to what's real. But here's the good news. The good news is everybody's in the same dilemma, and everybody draws pretty much the same kind of conclusions, so we all share that. You see where we are there? Well, he was no postmodernist, but he sure opened the door to it. I'm using, by the way, a chapter in my book on unchanging faith in a changing world for this particular, for a few of the quotes. So I'm cheating by using my own stuff. But, you know, Kant was not a postmodernist. He believed that all of our minds imposed the same basic structure in the world. That's a real short step from today's postmodernism. Take away this assumption that all human minds are drawing the same kind of conclusions, and you're in total chaos. Not only can you not know what the world is, you don't even know what other people are thinking. You're not even sure what other people. In fact, they came up with the idea that reality is a construction. It's a construction that you impose upon things, but it has very little to do with what things truly are. We just say it's a reality. And actually, it's a social construction because we do it in groups, ethnic groups and other groups. So each group has its own social construction of reality, and thus we have a pluralistic world where all kinds of things are intersecting. As one critic put it, Chinese food or French cuisine, Jesus or Nostradamus, permed or straight, life or death, they're all the same. What you choose does not matter, only your freedom in choosing. Now, the danger with that, though, is it makes it appear that it's just a matter of preference, just like Chinese food versus, let's say, Indian food. What if we put it this way? Arsenic, apples, what does it matter what you eat? Cyanide and grape juice, what does it matter? Well, some folks in Jonestown discovered the difference between grape Kool-Aid and cyanide that was laced in it. You see the point here? Maybe it does matter in some. It doesn't matter much about your clothing choice, but it sure does matter whether you drive on the left side of the street in the morning or the right. You see, especially when you crest a hill and you're not sure which side is the rule, which is exactly the way most Americans, if they're going to have an accident in England, do it. The first day they're over there, they get used a little bit to driving on the left side of the road. Here's what happens. The next morning, they get in their car, and they forget where they are, and where they get killed, if they're going to get killed, is when they're driving in the morning, and they crest a hill, and there's another thing coming at the same moment. And they don't swerve in the right direction. It's all over. You see the problem there? I suggest that it does matter a good deal which side of the street you drive on, you see. It's not a question of just a social construction of reality. In fact, you and I are very particular, are we not, as to what runway our commercial airliner will choose and when he chooses to do that landing. I'm rather particular about that. I'd like him to be in the right altitude so that he's not going to be in the wrong airspace. You see where I'm particular fussy, and my car is awfully fussy about what I put in it. I want to put in water. It's a lot cheaper. It tells me, no, you better put in some expensive gasoline. You see where I'm going with? Specifically, it better be unleaded gasoline. Not diesel fuel. In fact, as we live our lives, we discover that in practice, it's one thing to get real ethereal and to kind of float around, everything's cool. When you get down to the day-by-day give and take of the way you and I live, it turns out we are, in fact, very particular about things, and some things are right and some things are dead wrong in the way we live. And that's true in terms of what we think, in terms of what's true, what's beautiful, and what's good. The way we actually live betrays ourselves. I'm suggesting that we live, and I'm going to jump ahead for a minute. I'm suggesting that the way people actually live their lives from 9 in the morning until 9 at night, the way they actually make decisions and the way they interact with this world actually turns out not to be a relativistic world, but a commonly shared world. For example, say I go out to a room there and it has a tile floor. I say, watch it, the floor is wet. The guy says, that may be true in your reality, but in my reality, it's not true. Now, what would you do with such a thing? Well, I could get the guy, here, bend down and feel that stuff. What is that wet stuff? Well, it's not really water, it just has the illusion. You know, you can press that far enough, but you'd have to be an idiot to do that, if you see where I'm going with that. I'm just suggesting that the way we really live really does say some things are right, and if they're right, they by nature exclude the other, because the floor, a square foot of floor, can't be completely wet and completely dry at the same time and in the same sense. Are you tracking with me here? And I'm just saying the way we go, the way we live, is one thing. But the danger is we can buy in these silly ideas so that we are consistent and we strain at the gnats of day-by-day reality, and then we swallow the camel of ultimate reality by saying anything goes when it comes to ultimate reality. So I'm suggesting here that the only thing you've got, if you make this claim that we can't know anything, is basically the social construction is based upon either what makes sense and seems to make sense for a group of people or what works. Not that it's true, it just makes some sense for some folks, or that it works. You see the idea here? I'm going to be suggesting here, though, that there's a problem with that, because it's actually self-destructive. This message will self-destruct in 2 minutes. Remember that deal here? Some messages are self-destructive. For example, there are self-defeating propositions. If I write the sentence, I can't write a sentence in English, and I just wrote that sentence. What's the problem with that? If the sentence is true, it's false, and if it's false, it's true. If you press it hard enough, because he just wrote a sentence in English. Or the classic liar's paradox is, everything I tell you is a lie. That's got to be self-refuting, because if it were true, the very statement would be a lie. You with me on that? But if it were a lie, then not everything he told you would be a lie. You see, some things just defeat themselves. They don't need anything else to kill themselves. Have you ever heard a person say all knowledge is relative? Is that statement also relative? You see the point there? How do you know that statement's true? The truth is that there is no truth is a self-defeating proposition. How do you know that's true? It defeats itself. Or Jean Paul Sartre's mistress, Simone de Beauvoir, said it is forbidden to forbid. You see the inconsistency with this sort of a thing. All knowledge is a human construction. Oh, is that, and that part is also? So how do you know it's true? I'm suggesting that actually it doesn't take a lot of analysis to show that these kinds of things, by their own rules, kill themselves. And if you have a humbler, less aggressive form of relativism, you might say, well, I don't know if all knowledge is relative for everyone. I just know all knowledge is relative for me. But to such an assertion, you have to ask whether this knowledge itself is relative. You see? And in other words, if his knowledge of relativism is not subject to change, then it's absolute. And so you go on to this, you have this problem here where no one can even argue or provide evidence for this concept of it being this way without actually refuting themselves, because you have to use evidence that you're appealing to other people to buy into when actually nobody knows what anybody really thinks anyway. Do you see what I'm saying? If you analyze it logically, it self-destructs. The appearance of a stick partially submerged in water is often used as an illustration. Look, it looks like it's bending this way to that guy. The other guy over here sees it entirely different. Thus, it's all relative. No, not exactly. Because we already know, we both agree that it's in water. And hey, I can take person A and put him where person B was, put person B where person A was, and they both agree that it changed in the same way and in the same sense. You tracking with me here? You didn't know I was going to give you a lecture in epistemology, but that's basically what I'm doing. But I'm just suggesting, and it gets easier after this. Now, I admit, nobody knows everything. I admit that we have very clear limits. And I'm suggesting it, though, that reality, here's one way of defining it, is the given setting in which our efforts to construct a worldview takes place. It sets the boundaries and conditions of those efforts. In other words, reality is both the field in which we play the game of knowledge and the rules by which the game of knowledge is governed, and you can't know everything. That's true. But at the same time, so that's where enlightenment is completely off, the enlightenment philosophy. You won't, without revelation, unaided human reasoning will not come up with absolute answers to all the questions of life. It's impossible for not finite humans, but that skepticism going the other extreme goes too far. What we tend to do is to reimage reality, and what we do is deconstruct history, and now we provide a mythology for history in the name of history, and people figure it's all cool because, after all, it doesn't matter. That's a scary thing, because it's the same stuff that's done when we say that the Holocaust never took place. You see? And when you start playing those games, you're in some severe trouble. Because the same logic that you can say, really, that was just an illusion, is the kind of thing that could be used by a Nazi propagandist as well, that this isn't real. Let me move on from there and just throw out a few other thoughts. By the way, the idea that there's no absolute truth, in 1991, the general population, 67% claimed that there was no absolute truth in the general population. Among evangelicals, the figure was 52%, which is quite surprising. Now, in 1994, it jumped from 67% in the general population. This is the general. This is the evangelicals. By evangelical, I mean people who claim to believe that the Bible is a legitimate source of authority and truth. The amazing thing is 67% said that there was no absolute truth, and 52% of the evangelicals went along with it. And that was in 1991. In 1994, the figure jumped from 67 to 72%, a differential of 5. Now, the interesting thing here, though, with the evangelicals is it went from 52 to 62%, so you had a differential of 10. That's pretty interesting. Guess who's catching up? You see where it's going here? I'd be interested in seeing a 1999 figure to see where it's gone. What I'm arguing here is that people are not thinking in ways that are really consistent with reality. As Malcolm Muggeridge put it, our 20th century, far from being notable for scientific skepticism, is one of the most credulous, gullible errors in all history. And he's right. People are believing stuff now that the ancients would have laughed at. It's like, it reminds me of Steve Martin. He says, you know, I'd be a complete, total skeptic if it weren't for my lucky astrology mood watch. It's not that people believe in nothing, Muggeridge goes on to say, which would be bad enough, but that they believe in anything, which is terrible. And what we have is an age where people know more than people used to know, but they're also more gullible than people ever were before. They don't have as much common sense as they used to have. Thomas Boswell wrote a book called Why Time Begins on Opening Day, talking about the metaphor of baseball. And what he said was this: born to an age where horror has become commonplace, and it has. Have you noticed that, by the way? Where tragedy has, by its monotonous repetition, become a parody of sorrow, and it has. We need to fence off a few parks where humans try to be fair, where skill has some hope of reward, where absurdity has a harder time than usual getting a ticket. See, that's one of the things why people like baseball, is it still has rules, and skill really is rewarded, and where absurdity is not going to be tolerated. People admire that because at least there really are some things and some rules by which people go. Now, we can be really vulnerable to all sorts of lies and deceptions. Mark Twain used to put it this way: truth may be eternal, but a lie told well is a thing of beauty and a joy forever. I'm thinking there's a novel, one of Steinbeck's novels, East of Eden, had a figure, Kathy, and this little statement was telling. But Kathy did not forget her lies. By the way, if you're a good liar, you have to remember all that you lie. You understand that? A good liar has to have a long memory because they build this construction here, and it better well be consistent. She didn't forget her lies, and she developed the most effective method of lying. She stayed close enough to the truth so that one could never be sure. She knew two other methods also, either to interlard her lies with truth or to tell a truth as though it were a lie. If one is accused of a lie and it turns out to be the truth, there is a backlog that will last a long time and protect a number of untruths. You see how that works? Two Duke students went away for a weekend, and they came to the professor because they were late for the examination at 8 o'clock in the morning on Monday. And these two Duke students said, our car broke down. We had a flat tire. And so we would like to be given the privilege of taking this exam a little bit later, the next day. The professor surprisingly agrees. And he sends them, when he gives them the examination, into two separate rooms. The examination has two questions. One question's worth 5%, and the other question is worth 95%. The second question has two words. Which tire? Which tire? You catch the point here? Is it really a social construction of reality or not? There is such a thing called evidence that can work very well. There's a man who was killed on a railroad crossing, and his relatives sued the railroad, and they claimed that there was negligence on the part of the watchman in that particular situation. So during the ensuing trial, what happened is the watchman was called to the witness stand, and the prosecuting attorney asked him several questions. Were you on duty at the crossroads at the time of the accident? And he said, yes, I was. He said, did you have a lantern? Yes, I did. And did you wave your lantern in warning? And he said, yes, I did. So his testimony helped the railroad win the case. Now, an officer of the railroad came to see the watchman a little later, and he wanted to thank him for giving evidence that helped them out. Now, the officer inquired, you know, Mr. Jarvis, were you nervous at any point during the trial? To which Mr. Jarvis, the watchman, said, "Yes, sir, I feared at any moment that the attorney would ask, was the lantern lit?" You see the problem here. You can tell some truths and not tell some truths. So it's an issue of discernment and using our evaluation. And the problem is that there are a great number of ways of deceiving and lying. There are several ways of arriving at issues of truth. One of those ways of growing, of arriving at truth is, as I said before, relativism that basically says true, it's only true for us, you see. Whatever you want is cool for you, it's not maybe not true for you. That's your truth, but not my truth. That, have you all heard that phrase? That's maybe true for you, but it's not true for me. There's no such thing as a universal truth. Subjectivism is the view that that's true only because I feel it is true. And there's pragmatism that tells me it's true because it happens to work. So it must be true because it works. You can, without going into a lot of detail, see that there's a real series of problems with all those views. A lot of it has to do, many people's source of authority for truth is the mooing herd. The mooing herd. You know, there's the majority of people, so they take truth by majority vote. You know, the 50 million Frenchmen can't be wrong. Well, it turns out that they can be wrong. In fact, it turns out if you look at the history of science, the majority of opinion, most of the time, has been wrong over the centuries. You with me here? Before Copernicus and so forth, and for a good while after him, and on all sorts of areas. It was only recently, for example, in our own century, that the Michelson-Morley experiment demonstrated that there was no such thing as ether, that they thought that light was carried on this in this substance. And so, we're suggesting here that people bought into all kinds, and the majority bought, and they held them so tenaciously that you had to be an idiot not to believe it. You see the idea? Not to buy into it. Everybody knows the assured results of modern science or whatever our field is. There's a certain arrogance when you get into that, particularly when your field turns out to be a path that's strewn with discarded theories along the way. It might be wise to acknowledge the limitations of science and its tentative nature so that you have a little bit of humility about the area. Majority truths, majority votes. National Socialism in Germany illustrates that the majority view, what most people, that may not in fact correspond to reality. So what do you come to? You have some kind of a personal authority. So you come to your guru, you know, and you find, you come to your, why is he correct as opposed to another one? And it comes down to this issue of putting faith in some kind of a system that you've got to trust in, but you can't absolutely demonstrate. And I'm arguing that there are only, that for most people today, it's their culture that sort of determines what's true and what's not true. And people unthinkingly buy into the assumptions of the culture that are generated by media, education, and entertainment, and just unthinkingly, like the mooing herd, say, this is the way it must be. They don't realize that what they've done all their lives is watch TV and give opinions. Not many people are really thinking, interacting, and working hard in dealing with issues along those kinds of lines. Three umpires were having a Coca-Cola after a baseball game. One umpire said, there's balls and there's strikes, and I call them the way they are. The second umpire said, there's balls and there's strikes, and I call them the way I see them. The third umpire said, there's balls and there's strikes, and they ain't nothing until I call them. Now the first one represents naive realism. You didn't know I was going with something on here. I call them the way they are is naive realism. I can know the reality completely and assuredly. The second one says I call them the way I see them, a critical realism, that I evaluate. I realize I might have an error, but at least I judge the evidence, use my experience, and draw conclusions. The third one's a postmodernist, basically. They're nothing until I call them. In other words, they become what I call them. Whatever I say they are, they become. And they may be true for you, but you're not the umpire. You see how that works here? We probably think that most umpires are postmodernists, the way they call balls and strikes. They seem to have nothing to do with reality. Would you agree? It's reminiscent of Ravi Zacharias, a comment that he made in a book of his. where a student at NYU, which was one of my schools, intimidatingly asked the professor, "Sir, how do I know that I exist?" He challenged the philosophy professor. So he figured that nailed him. A lingering pause preceded the professor's answer. He lowered his glasses, peered over the rim, and riveted his eyes to the student, and he then said, "And whom shall I say is asking?" Not a bad answer, would you agree? Fortunately, some things are just plain undeniable, and you have to go on basic truths that we all realize are undeniable, without which you can't even get off, going back to the baseball metaphor, first base. You just can't get off it. And you could say, who knows that I might be a butterfly having a dream, or I might be a human dreaming he's a butterfly, dreaming he's a human. You can play all kinds of, you know very well where you are and what you're doing here. That turns out to be Monday night, and you're in Piedmont Center. And we're all here, and we kind of interact together. You see, you can play games, but the way you live. And frankly, any other way becomes self-refuting once again, if we go back to that. You know, there are some beautiful theories, but those facts can be very nasty. You have to watch them. They get real, they're toughs. As another person put it, a hypothesis passes into a prejudice when the facts no longer stand as a threat to one's attitude toward a given data situation. Let me say that again. A hypothesis passes into a prejudice when the facts no longer stand as a threat to one's attitude toward a given data situation. In other words, when the facts don't really matter. When the hypothesis is impervious to the facts, we have a problem, do we not? You see, there are such things as evidences. And the fact is that here's how it works, that we all have basic presuppositions that we hold on to, that you exist and I exist. There is such a thing as the minds, and there are other minds out there. I can't, by the way, prove that there are other minds. Did you know that? I can't philosophically prove that there are other minds out there, even that I have a mind, and so forth. But we have certain basic presuppositions that really have a good way of working consistently. You know, the illusion of sitting on a tack has, you know, I may say that it's an illusion, but the pain that it produces, you know, from that illusory tack is awfully consistent. You see the problem here? Arose by any other name, all that sort of idea. But all these presuppositions we hold by faith. Now, I claim that faith itself is not a bad thing. We all live by faith. Your faith is only as good as the object in which it's placed. You're sitting in a seat right now. You're assuming that it's going to hold your body weight. All of a sudden, whoop, half the thing goes down. I remember being at a concert, and it was sad because it was funny at the same time as tragic. Because the top row of singers, there were four tiers. The top row of singers, all of a sudden, whoop, they disappeared. All these heads disappeared. And there was a terrible crash. The risers in the back row had crashed. Now, you didn't want to laugh, but it really was pretty funny to see. All of a sudden, these heads go down, and whoom, you know, dust rises up and so forth. Now, here's a situation. They had faith, did they not? They didn't even worry about the riser, but it turned out the faith was put in the wrong object. All of us live by faith. I remember driving, I had a Chevy 409, and I just put a super tune on the thing. You know, I had a nice four-barrel Holley carburetor on the thing, and my Hurst shifter. This is back in the 60s, as you can imagine. And I had this thing really in pretty fine order here. And I was at the fraternity house, so I was a sophomore in the fraternity here, and I had my hot rod. And I wanted to impress some friends that had, I had just met a couple of friends, and so put one friend in the back, and these two people I'd never met before, they got in the back seat. They were unhappy that happened, because what happened is I kind of pulled out and gave it all it had. And I was doing about 60 miles an hour by the time I hit the end of the driveway, and we went airborne. I forgot about the fact that there's a little dip. So we went airborne. And then, boom, boom. And then I continued and then blew it into second. And at about 90 miles an hour, as I'm making my shift, I'm coming up to a T-intersection, suddenly realize I have no brakes. That sinking, horrible feeling when you push your foot down and you realize there are no brakes. I had severed the brake lines when I hit the bottom. There was no brake fluid. What a horrible reality. Now, weird things take place when such a thing occurs. Time slowed down. It really did. And I've had weird situations. The way I react, it's just the opposite of panic. I have no emotion at all. I say I have just enough time to do one downshift before I'm going to hit the curve in front of me.